Testing, testing, testing. Can you hear me? This is Audible Autism.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Audible Autism, Interesting Questions and Interesting Facts. I'm your co-host Sarah, and this episode is actually a recording of a talk to Mark Autism Awareness Week given by Libby, an autistic person and an animal care technician from Plymouth. Libby explains her autistic journey from her diagnosis at the age of 4 through to becoming selectively mute, overcoming difficulties accessing the support she needed and the solutions she and her family found for her, and eventually her graduation and entrance to university. This talk was given at Stoke Newington Library. Hope you learned something.
Okay, so my name is Libby, and I'm a student at the University of Plymouth. I study animal behaviour and welfare. I live in Devon on the Moors, and I'm here today to talk to you about my journey with autism. I was first diagnosed with selective mutism, so that means I didn't speak, and I was also diagnosed with extreme anxiety, so I didn't speak to anyone outside of my house, not at school, just my mum and dad, and even if anyone else was around, I would just talk to my parents, but I would whisper. I didn't have signs of autism until the ages of 1 and 2 years old, and doctors actually noticed it, but they didn't diagnose it till I was 3 or 4, so I didn't have any eye contact. I was very withdrawn, and I was very anxious, and I had frequent meltdowns every single day. So this happened when my brother was born, and he's the youngest of us all, so I didn't know any different up until he was born. So when change happened, I just became very anxious and not myself at all, and just that's when I was diagnosed. So I remember when he was born, actually, and I was told that mum was pregnant, and I said, oh, that's great, she's having a baby. But no one told me that we were keeping him. So with my autism, people have to tell me exactly what's happening and what's going on. So Nan stayed over one night, and Mum and Dad got to the hospital, and I was like, oh, this is great. We're having a sleepover, everything's cool. And then the next day, I saw this little baby, and I ran to my mum, and I was like, what is this? And then he came home, and that's when I realised my brother's staying. So I cried for 3 days straight. And that was the turning point of when I went really downhill. So I started school, and it got even worse then. I would have a meltdown every single day before I left, and I couldn't read or write, and there was no support for me there. Like, the teachers just had no idea, and they couldn't help me at all. So I eventually got moved to another school, another mainstream school, and they couldn't help me either. I actually lasted a week at that school because I ran away. So they were told that I had to have someone with me 24/7, and they weren't with me at all. So it was just a young girl that was with me, and it should have been an adult, and it wasn't. So I ran away to the park after we were walking to the library, and they had lost me the whole day. So as a child, I was probably about 6 or 7, and I was lost. And they actually joked about it to my mum, saying, oh, she's wandered off, and it's funny, and it really wasn't. There was also keypads on the doors of the school, and obviously as a child who couldn't even read or write, how was I going to get into the toilets and things like that? So then I was homeschooled for 2 years, and at this point I wouldn't leave the house, so I was highly anxious, and this affected my siblings a lot, because At least one of my parents had to stay home with me constantly, and I just was going even more downhill than what I was. So I couldn't find a special school that was suited to my needs, so I was put into a hospital school. Now, I still had no clue, no idea what was happening. I didn't know why I had to be at school. Well, I don't know how common they are, but this hospital school was at the top of our local hospital, and it was just a room. And there was a teacher, and it looked like a classroom, but it was just me and her. So it was one-to-one support. I think it's mostly for very sick children. that had stayed in hospital and wanted to learn still and had to learn still. So I was the exception where I wasn't physically or sick in that way, but I was just lost and had autism. So I couldn't. So I went there and I didn't even take my coat off for a month, did I, Dad?
No.
I wouldn't pick up a pen. So I didn't know how common hospital schools were, because the one I was actually at had closed. It's closed now, unfortunately. But I had been homeschooled for 2 years after not coping in a mainstream environment. And I was working one-to-one with this teacher called Miss James. And she worked with me for 2 years, but for the first month I wouldn't take my coat off or I wouldn't hold even a pen. I just wasn't coping and I didn't know why I was there. But the main point was no one explained to me that I had to take my coat off. So because of my autism, I have to be explained directly what's happening, what's going on. So after that, I started getting used to the school and it got a little bit better. And she worked with me on a reward system. So if I did something good, then I would get to play board games or something like that. And she was amazing. Like, there's photos here of me and her on like some school trips. And that's actually after I left the school. So we're still in contact.
How old were you at the hospital school?
Was I about seven?
Yes.
I was about seven.
Very young.
Very young. So I'd already been to two mainstream schools and wasn't open. So I was very young and I couldn't get into a special school because of where I lived. So I lived outside of the city and they wouldn't fund me to go to the city to get into a special school because there was nothing else around my area. So we had this big fight and I was there for 2 years, would you say?
Yeah. Where is that hospital?
Limerick Hospital, so at the top. And it was the best thing that happened to me going to that hospital school, I would say. Because, yes, I was cut off from other children and things like that, but they gave me the basic skills. I couldn't even write my own name when I first went to that school. So it just shows how much Miss James did with me.
Do you think it was the one-to-one situation that
helped? I think so, and she was so good with me, so if I didn't want to do something, she would encourage me, but she wouldn't ever force me to do anything. And I think she worked really well. She was highly trained in autism, so she was amazing. And we're still in contact now. So when I was young, I would have frequent meltdowns. I've made a list here of sort of some of the things that I did when I was having these meltdowns. So I'd quite often bite myself, and I would hit my head, especially against the radiator at home. And it was very extreme. But quite often I didn't know it was happening or I couldn't control it, and that's the main thing. That's the main point I like to get across to people, is that it wasn't a choice, it just happened. So I would hit myself and quite often you just left me to it, which is the best thing for me, I think, because there was no stopping it. I just had to stop eventually. And afterwards I was quite tired and trying to think of the word. I just didn't feel like myself for at least a couple of days because I was just knackered. And then I would probably have another one in those couple of days. So then I was constantly tired and constantly stressed from all this energy and adrenaline. And that's a couple of photos for me because that's when like my parents knew I was going to have a meltdown, was when I started to bite my hands. So sort of the more positive side of autism when I was younger, I found comfort in cuddly toys. So I love cuddly toys even now. It's just a comfort thing because I didn't know how to find comfort in people, so I would find it in objects. So that's what I did. And I didn't enjoy close contact, so I wouldn't hug my parents or really go near anybody. I just like to keep to myself. But I did care. That's the main point, is that I did care and I was... Like, I did want to have comfort, but I didn't know how to be comforted. I didn't know whether to go in for a hug or wait to be hugged. I didn't understand that. I was obsessed with animals, and I still am. Animals is my thing. I would quite happily go up to a cat and a dog and talk to it, but person, not at all. We spent a lot of time at the beach, and that every summer we would spend pretty much the whole 6 weeks, wouldn't we, at the beach and at our caravan. That was when I was happiest. So I used to pace and I used to flap my hands all the time. And that's when I was happy. So you've got so much energy and so much happiness inside you that you need to do something to sort of get rid of that energy. And you would do it without even noticing, well, I would anyway. and I would constantly flap my hands, and now I actually squeeze my hands instead. So I, as a teenager, I started training myself to do it differently. And even though I'm all for, you know, do what you like and no one judge you, but as a teenager, I didn't want anyone knowing, I suppose. And that's photos of me with my toy and at the beach. I had a pony when I was younger as well, because my grandparents have a farm, so I spent pretty much all my time there. So I had a very close relationship with my nan. I spent most days with her. And as you can see, I didn't really like contact, but with my nan, it was sort of a different story. I spent every day with her and her dog on her farm, and that was a really happy time for me. But as I said before, it was a strange relationship with my siblings still, because one was younger and one was older, and they would like to make jokes, and I just didn't understand. I was pacing constantly in front of the TV, so you can imagine how annoying that would be. I was also attached to my parents, so I always had to have one of them around. So eventually, I joined special school. That took a lot of fighting. So before I went into special school, we had a tribunal, because at the hospital school, there was a education psychologist.
Yes, that's right.
He took me out of lesson without me knowing, them knowing, and I didn't know what was happening. And he put me in a room, and he said I was a naughty girl, and he said I was doing it on purpose. He said, it's not autism, you're just very naughty. So Mum and Dad had no idea about this, actually. And
how old are you? I'm just thinking.
At the time, I was 7
years old.
So the 1990s.
Yes.
But the whole thing...
2002?
Yes.
The reason
that happened was because of where I lived, they didn't... Because we were fighting to get into this new school, they didn't want us to get to that new school. So he thought convincing me that I was normal or that I didn't have autism would help the situation in not getting me in that school, because my region didn't have... schools.
Any special needs schools too?
No. Or no help. So it would be cheaper for them just to say, you know, you don't have it, there's no point. And I didn't realise that at the time, obviously I was only 7. So I went home and I had a meltdown, didn't I?
Yeah, massive meltdown. Absolutely.
You didn't know why.
We didn't have a clue.
No.
No.
And then the tribunal happened, didn't it? And
yes.
Miss James, because you asked Miss James to go to the tribunal and help me with it. And he was there, wasn't he, that psychologist? And he tried apologising to you and stuff, didn't he? And Miss James nearly got fired for going to that tribunal because they really didn't want me going to that school, but she was willing to get fired to go to it. And we won the case, and it was around Christmas I went to the special school. And I'd say that was also the best thing that happened to me, so probably about the same level as hospital school, I suppose. And that was more like a school. It was quite a big school. It had like primary and secondary years in it. But it was small enough to cope with, and there was lots of people like myself and people with other disabilities, so it was a really nice environment. So I made a lot of new friends, and they didn't ever force you to do anything, and that was the main point. I was still very, very quiet. I'd started talking at this point, but I was still so quiet, so they didn't ever force me to do anything. And I was in this play, wasn't I? And I was just stood at the back, and I was all quiet, and again, wasn't forced to do anything. And Mum and Dad were watching, and you could see that I was just not comfortable with it. And this lady next to my Mum and Dad said, this time next year, she'll be up there, and she'll be talking in the presentation. So... a year went past, and I was actually singing in a church in front of all these people. And even now, I can't believe that I did that. And it just showed how much confidence I had built in a year of me being there. So they were highly trained in autism as well, so they just knew what they were doing, and it was the perfect place for me, and I should have been there all along.
Was that near where you lived?
That was Plymouth, so it was the area they didn't want me to be in. But it wasn't... Well, it wasn't miles away, was it?
It was different education authorities, Plymouth and Devon.
So it wasn't miles away, but it was a fair trek, so I had to get a taxi there and back.
It wasn't residential?
No. I don't know if I'd have coped with that, because of my attachment to my parents and things like that. I don't know how I would have coped with that. So it was nice to go back every day, and I enjoyed it there a lot. And they also prepared me for college. So during my teenage years, I actually hid my diagnosis from my friends and people I met. I didn't want anyone to know. I think it's because I didn't know how I felt about it at the time. And I just didn't want anybody to know. But I learned to travel independently, so we did travel training at the special school, and I could get on a bus, and I went everywhere, didn't I? I went everywhere on a train, on a bus. Here, there, and everywhere, didn't I?
Yes.
And that helped a lot because I was so much more independent. And I also started taking classes in a mainstream school, so while I wasn't doing GCSEs, I was sort of working alongside them, even though I wasn't going to get a GCSE out of it. It was nice to sort of be introduced back into that environment because I was going to go to college, which was a mainstream environment. So that prepared me quite a lot. So I went to college and I started off at level one animal care. And that's sort of a startup course. It's not GCSE or anything like that. It's just a starting course. And obviously it's in something I love as well, so I was really passionate about it. I was still very, very quiet though at this point, and I just kind of kept to myself.
What point did you stop being selectively mute?
You were around about 5 years old when she started to speak to other members of the family, like her grandfather. And then it grew from there, starting to speak to other people.
Yeah, because I forgot to mention at that time I was having meetings with a psychologist who was a child psychologist, and she put me in a room and she got these toys out, which was probably like crocodiles and anything animal related she tried to get me to talk with. So she talked to me using animals, and I probably didn't answer most of the time. And I remember turning up one day, and I remember talking to her, and she just sat there like this, because I had actually talked to her. And there was just a clicking point for me where I'd had so many of these meetings, and I was kind of looking at the other children, and I said, I kind of want to be involved now. But it wasn't until I made the choice to talk. I wasn't going to talk.
Can I ask a question? It's really difficult because you were so young.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm that way. What did you choose not to speak because you couldn't
yes.
see the point in speaking, or you couldn't see the benefit, or you thought it's going to create all this social conversation and I'm going to struggle with it?
How I remember it is that when someone spoke to me, it felt like as if someone had their hand here, and it was like squeezing, and it hurt, and I knew how to talk, but it was, you know, quiet, I can't talk now. And it was a choice, but at the same time, it was almost as if I couldn't, even though I could. And it's really hard to explain, but it was as if someone was grabbing me here, and it's just, it's anxiety. That's what it is. And that was the main problem, because I had so much anxiety that it took me so long to talk. But then I had that click point where I was like, you know what, it's time to talk.
So would you say, it's fair to say that people who are diagnosed as selectively mute, because you get older people and adults, it's anxiety.
I believe so. Yeah, I do believe that. I also think they can understand what you're saying as well. I do believe that when I was mutistic, I did have a mental age younger than what I was. So while I did understand some things I probably wouldn't have, but in general, I did understand what people were saying. So when I was in college, I finished level one. And I then did level two, which is GCSE level. So alongside that, I did English and maths. And I really did struggle with that. But because, again, animal science is my thing, I did really well and started getting better. And it was hard in college because they would mention a lot. They would say, you'll remember this from school. And quite often, I didn't do that in school because I wasn't at GCSE level. And that was the hardest bit. Even now at uni, they go, oh, you'll remember this. And I was like, no, I don't. So I have to be taught it as if I was at school. So then I went on to level three animal management, which is A levels. And that was fine. I really enjoyed that. Less practical, because in the other levels, it was more about working with the animals. Whereas when you get to A levels, it's more of the sciencey side. But I really enjoy science, so it wasn't really a problem. I started working as a student ambassador at this time as well. So I basically took people around for tours of the college and open days and things like that. And I did that because in level three and in the degree, I would have to do presentations. So I thought, what a good way to practice talking about the animals and learning as well. So I did that every few weeks. And I also took students with disabilities around and taught them about animals as well. So that was really useful because I could also talk to their parents, because usually they had their parents with them, and they'd say, oh, just warning you, they're autistic. And I'd be like, well, I am too, so that's fine. Oh, at this point, yes. When I hit level 3, I stopped hiding it from my friends because sometimes it was really obvious and they just didn't know what was wrong. So I thought, well, I'm starting to get comfortable with it now. I'm taking people who've also got disabilities around them. I'm not ashamed of it. I wasn't really ashamed, but I was more like, I don't want to hide anymore. Because otherwise, people aren't, say if I had a meltdown at college, people wouldn't know what to do. So, it, you know, it was good to talk about. Oh, I also did volunteering. So I worked at a rescue centre for 2 years. And that was brilliant because I got to work with cats and dogs. But the motivator for doing all this really was when that psychologist said to me, you're never going to do anything, that just motivated me more to do things. And it's almost like, you know, I can have a job and I can do things. So it was such a big motivator. Even at that young age, I remember it word for word. So then I went on to university, but it was in a university building. So it was at the college I was studying at. So it was the same environment. I knew the same people. So it was really good. It was a good start-off point, the foundation degree. So it wasn't a full degree. But it got me used to how different it was compared to college. So I then started working as an animal care technician at the college. So they offered me a job, and it was near the end of my foundation degree, because I was really going to miss that college, because since school, that was my, you know, place to be, that was my home, almost. So they offered me a job, and I said, yes, of course I will. And I get to work there in the summer and on weekends sometimes. And I really, really enjoy it. It's a good job to have. Oh, and I graduated in November as well.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So then I went to Plymouth University in September, and that's a completely different environment. It was huge. It's huge, and I didn't know how to feel when I first started, because my friends from my college that I went to, they were at the same uni, but they were in a different course. So I was the only one from my foundation degree that was doing the course I was doing. So the first week was quite stressful, and I was just sort of wandering around like a lost puppy. And I walked down this hallway, and I couldn't find my first lecture. And I was like, no, it's not a good start. And then I ran into this girl here, Chloe. She was like, are you doing animal behavior? And I said, yes. And she said, okay, stick with me. We're going to go into lecture. I said, okay. Because she could kind of see that I was just wandering around. So then I met these other people. And you can't see him there, but I met Rebecca, and we sort of formed this really nice group, and that's helped a lot, I think, with getting used to lecture, because I told them pretty much straight away. I was like, I'm autistic, this is how it is. And they were like, totally fine, and they're actually really helpful at uni. So I did a presentation in November or December, and this was a stressful one because it was marked, and I'm a bit nervous anyway, so that was stressful enough, and it was timed as well, so you had to get it exactly 10 minutes, and I didn't know how I felt about this, but luckily it was a group presentation. So we were sat in the study room, and they said, Liv, okay, do your bit, and this is luckily just before the presentation, and I said, I can't do it. So I started like hyperventilating, and I could feel like a meltdown coming on, I could just feel it, and I said, I can't do it. So Rebecca, they were like, okay, let's stop. And Chloe got her phone out, she put some David Attenborough on, love David Attenborough, and they put some music on, and we just sat there, and they were like, it's fine, everything's okay, you're going to be fine. And that's when I knew like they were a really good group of people, because they were willing to do that, and I think some people would have got a little bit freaked out about it, but they just knew exactly what to do. Even just me telling them I had autism, they just went into action, so they're a really good group of people to have.
Are you friends?
Yeah, we're really good friends. And that I've told them all sorts of things, like I flapped my hands and they said, oh, why do you do that? And I said, I'm happy. And they said, okay, fine, carry on. So they're a really good group of friends to have. I also do have support at uni. So There's this lady called Barbara who helps me look over my coursework. She's not allowed to do anything to it, but she can say, maybe you should look at this paper, or maybe you can change this around. She can't give me much advice, but she's there to sort of help me. Especially if I get stressed, she can talk to me about that as well. So she's really good support to have. It's definitely worth looking into if you go to uni.
Can I ask a question? How easy was it, did you find it to get DFA compared with getting your special school?
Getting DSA?
No, that was quite difficult.
That was a struggle.
But it was only because the PIP came in and that all got changed around. And
It's the support that's
this
provided to students.
Yeah. And when Liberty last went to a PIP tribunal, they said there's nothing wrong with her.
So
they took the personal independence pain away. And they took everything away. And we had to go appeal, and then it came back, so then she could get the DSA.
She appealed her personal independence. She was denied
it, yeah.
So you had to go to appeal.
Yes. Yeah.
Having had DLA.
Yeah, you'd had DLA, and then, of course, it changed to PIP.
It was awful, I'll tell you about that, actually, because at this point of my PIP, I had learnt to drive, and I think that was the biggest factor of taking my money away. Which is really frustrating.
God forbid you should display competence.
Yeah, I know. So I got a car and everything's good. And then they were like, actually, you know where you're going, you can wash yourself, you can cook. Even though I'm very basic with my cooking. So, for example, with bacon, I didn't cook it for 2 years because it smelled at me and I didn't like the feeling of it. So I'm very sensitive, and usually other people have to cook for me because I just can't cope with it, but putting food in a microwave is classed as cooking in PIP's eyes, and that was frustrating. And because I can wash myself, they classed that as being fine, which also frustrates me because there's nothing wrong with me physically, it's obviously all anxiety related. And the woman was just very forceful, so when at our original talk, it was me and my mum there, and she was asking me all these questions, and she said, she got a tray out with some objects on it. She said, right, I've got to get you to remember these objects on the tray, I'll take it away, and you tell me what's on the tray. And I said, how is this relevant? Yeah. And then she asked me to spell a word backwards, and I was like, I'm not going to do that. And she was like, just do it. And I was like, oh, you can't tell me what I can't do. And then she said I was a normal weight, which clearly I'm not. And I was a normal weight, and clearly I'm not, because I've got trouble eating habits and like food. So she was just saying all these things that weren't really true or they're exaggerated, and I lost it, and it was
a
battle.
Well,
the second time actually with the tribunal, I didn't actually know what it was going to be like, so I went there totally blind. And there was a judge on one side, and there was an autism sort of specialist. I'm not really sure what she was, and there was a doctor. And it was like a proper tribunal, and I walked in and I was like, I can't cope. So I sat down and they said, what do you do then? And I said, animals. And I was just like, I can't cope. They were like, okay, fine. So I think that was enough proof that I had a lot of anxiety anyway. So they asked me all these questions. And the doctor was actually really nice. He was just asking me about work and my travel and driving. And I said, well, I can get to places, but if I get lost, then I'll sit there for a little while and think, oh, what do I do now? Or I'll Google map it. So it takes me a lot to ask for help. And I said this to them, and they said, yeah, fair enough. And then the autism specialist, I don't know how I feel about her. She was very, again, forceful. And she said to my mum, she said, why don't you teach her to cook? And I was like, that's not the problem. Like, I can cook, I just choose to be very basic with my cooking. And she was almost like blaming my mum, and I stood up for my mum, and I was like, no, that's not how it is. And I walked out of there, well, they're making the decision, I was like, I can't go back in there, can't. And I actually did win in the end. But to have to go through all that is too much, and imagine being on your own doing that, I don't think I could. Like, even with my mum there, that was difficult enough. So, yeah.
How long do they award it for? Is that too personal?
I don't actually know.
3 years.
Three years.
Three years.
It's how long's got it for 3 years.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
And then you have to apply again.
You shouldn't have to, really, should you?
No. You shouldn't. Yeah.
But you, when it comes to review, we need to think about it. Did you have any evidence? Did you have any paperwork, like doctor's reports?
Or yes.
Yeah, got doctor's reports and all that sort of thing.
But that shouldn't be a barrier to you getting VSA, because you've got a diagnosis and they have to do something around the diagnosis.
I think one of the other issues as well when it comes to PIP is that a lot of support drops away when you leave education anyway.
I agree. And when you turn an adult, like, everything's just gone.
You can have support from CAMHS and social services, but that just drops. And then you have no evidence, really, to show how you get support.
But just...
I was just going to ask, when were you diagnosed?
With autism, I was diagnosed at 3 or 4, so when my brother was born, that's when I was... diagnosed, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So doctors knew sort of before then, didn't they?
Well, they didn't say anything. And we, my wife and I, sort of scrabbled around in the dark, knowing that there was something going on. But then when we actually managed to get a meeting of all sort of different groups, the health visitor said, well, yes, I thought so when she was, I don't know, 11 months old. And we were just... Why didn't you say? Just why didn't you tell us?
I think there's a thing about as well, other people diminishing it. Like, oh yeah, but my son does that.
Yes. Yes, I've come across that quite often.
Yes.
I think one of the worst things was when you were young was the way the education authority, especially with that teacher at the hospital school, when we went to tribunal, because it was a massive fight to get to a tribunal, the education authority went to her and said, if you stick up for these parents, we will sack you. And she said, do it then, sack me, because I'm going. And then her union said, don't you worry, you go. And thankfully, because she really swung it for us.
I think that story is repeated again and again and again and again all over the country, and it's still happening.
Yeah.
It's still happening. And it's, you know, it's so damaging to families.
Yeah.
It's like sort of gaslighting.
Mm-hmm.
She saved us, saved Liberty. She really did.
Yeah.
And we'll be forever grateful for that teacher. Definitely.
It's silly that it all happened, really, because just over funding of where I lived. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
But it all is about funding. Always is about funding.
It is.
Yeah. Every single time.
So, as an adult, I still obviously do some of the behaviours I did when I was younger, but it's not as extreme. So I still pace, and that's usually when I'm thoughtful and I'm thinking about uni work or just general work. But I also do it when I'm sort of stressed as well. I used to pull out my hair and eyebrows when I was extremely stressed, and I stopped that a year ago. And instead, because that was really hard to stop, especially my eyebrows, I used to constantly put that there. I have jewellery on, so I'll constantly play with my necklace or my earrings when I'm sort of stressed or anxious, and that is a really good way to distract me, because I'll do it in the evening all the time. So I also plan out daily activities, so when I'm going to the shop, I can picture exactly what the shop's going to look like, because I tend to go to the same places. So I can picture out exactly what I'm going to buy, what I'm going to do when I'm in there, and I'll plan out conversations as well in my head. So, and I also have money in my hand before I go to the cashier. And that works, tends to work really well. Obviously, there's time rate changes, and I deal with that probably not as well. So yeah, I find that really works in shops and things. Obviously, like places like London, I can't really do that, but I think you'll agree that I do have a general idea. So because I've been to London like twice or three times, I'd say, I do know the layout somewhat. So we got the tube yesterday, didn't we? And I sort of knew the layout, even though I'd only been on it once, because I like to remember where I've been and what I've done in case anything does happen. It's like an emergency. And I do tend to remember buses and trains really well, and that's really useful to say if I'm ever stuck or if anyone needs help.
You're a new city member.
Pretty much, yeah. Like, my brain is just...
You've got your own city map.
I've got my own city map. No, I have Google Map, which actually helps. We used that earlier because I was like, I don't know. When we went to Natural History Museum, we used that, didn't we? But technology is so good now. It's so easy. Just Google from Stoke Newington to Natural History Museum. That's sorted. And that helps a lot. And also we're using the taxi app. What's it called? I can't remember what it's called.
Addison Lee.
Addison Lee. And we don't... Because I struggle phoning people. Anyway, it's not really good because you don't have to phone anybody. You just type in what time they pick you up, what time, where to drop you. And it's really good because I didn't have to be on the phone and I didn't have to worry about it. And it tracks where the taxi is as well. So it gives us their contact details. So there's no worry involved with that. And that's a really good scheme. And there's nothing like that where we are. So I generally avoid taxis because you have to call them. And I just don't know about taxis where I am. So... It's really useful that they're starting to develop these things. So I was talking earlier how I have an obsession with cuddly toys. That's what my bed currently looks like. So, yeah, so something's so changed. I still do flap my hands on pace when I'm at home. So generally what I'll do is I'll get into the house and I'll go, I'm going upstairs, and I'll go around the room and I'll pace and just think for a minute, flap my hands, do whatever, and then sit down and I'm fine. It's just after a whole day you need that need to unload, and that's what I do when I get home.
Can I just ask you about that? That give you as much
Yeah, because it didn't at first. Okay. I would probably do both at first.
Okay.
And then after a while, it's just a natural thing now. I don't realise I'm doing it. I was doing it the other day, and my friend's like, are you cold? I'm just happy. And I do literally do that all the time. I think, do you notice me doing it quite a lot? I do it all the time, especially when I'm happy. And I usually smile when I do it as well, and they always ask me what's funny. I'm like, oh, just something in my head. It's fine. So just with the coping strategies. I also go to the beach and the moors a lot because I've always loved the beach, as I said earlier. So I find that really calming, just the sound of the sea and just being in a quiet place just helps me a lot. I also do have a fidget spinner with me, so I'll have that. I don't tend to use it because I tend to use my necklace. But I went to Cardiff a few months ago and we went to the Doctor Who Museum and there was this boy behind me and he was having a bit of an issue. And I said, is he okay? And she said, yes, I think he's about to have a meltdown. And I just wish I had something on me then. So now I always carry something with me. So then, yeah, so just in case someone else sort of needs it.
That's so kind.
So the reason I'm sort of here today was that Adrian, who works for Hackney Libraries, he invited me to come here because I created a Twitter page in 2016 and I wasn't really sure on it at first. I was like, I'm exposing my life on the internet. Like, I don't know what kind of reaction I'm going to get. And luckily, it's been really positive and I love talking to people and like sort of pointing them in the right direction for things. And it's nice getting used to saying, oh, you really helped me. And I've had people say, we had no idea about mutism and we think our daughter's got it or our son's got it, so now we're going to get a diagnosis for that. And it's just really nice to hear. And I really enjoy being on it. It's really good. I'm also working with charities. So I'm currently working with Respect Yourself, and I don't know if anyone's heard of that. So they help young people. It doesn't matter if it's autism. And the main person contacted me and said, we would like you to help us. So then if anyone contacts us and say we're having a problem, I'd like you to help us, help them. I said, yeah, I don't mind. So I have regular phone calls with them, which is a big thing because I really don't like being on the phone, but I've got used to who she is, so I don't mind. And I'm going to hopefully work with other charities in the future. There's also this school in Plymouth, which are doing... I don't know what exactly they're doing. They're making an activity centre for people with autism, so they want to know what ideas I have, and I think they'll help in the community, so that's going to be exciting. Hopefully doing that Thursday. I did create a Facebook page. It's called Liberty Living with Autism. I haven't been as good on that because I don't use Facebook as much as Twitter, but I am going to use it more. So if anyone wants to like that, or like my Twitter page, then you can. And that was, that's pretty much it. But if anyone wants to talk more about anything I don't mind.
So you're in your first year at union?
Yes, it's my first year, but it's technically my second year. So that was a big challenge as well. I was talking to my tutor, because I love the uni. It's a really good uni, but I said there needs to be more support for second year, like direct students. Because we go in there and we're thrown into assignments, exams, and that's what I struggle with. Exams was a big thing. Because I had 3 exams at Christmas and I'd only started in September and I had assignments to go along with that. I thought, I can't cope with this. And then a few days before my exams, I messaged the Learning Gateway, which is like the disability sort of help area. I said, I don't know if I can do this. And I said, where are my exams? Because I don't even know that. They said, oh, it's in a hall with 200 people. And I was like, nope, cannot do it, not going to do it. And then they said, okay, that's fine. We'll put you in a smaller room. And I said, yes, that's great. And also, because I've got weak my hands and my legs, I didn't mention that earlier, I tend to use a laptop or a computer to write because my hands cramp up really easily. So they gave me a computer, which made life so much easier with writing, because I probably wouldn't have got as much done in the exam. I don't, especially 3 exams, that would have tired me out. So while uni has given me a lot of support, I think there needs to be more done for the second year. Especially third years, because my friends have gone straight into third year. I don't know how to cope with that straight off.
You get extra time.
I get extra time, yeah. And I can have somebody read out the questions for me as well, but I'm perfectly fine with reading, so.
What do you get the extra time for? Is that the dyslexia?
I think it's dyslexia.
I think general policy is just to give everyone requested 25% extra time.
Yeah.
You don't really need to justify it if you're registered disabled.
Okay.
It's a bit simpler. I know at the universities, I remember phoning up before we went to look at the exam, and they said, you can't talk to us this week, we're just sorting out everybody's extra time. Yeah. So they do it in big industrial batches, rather than at schools, where you sort of, not at residential school, but so I know friends of mine, they've had to chase the school. And they say, oh yes, maybe they do need a separate room, maybe they do need the extra time. And they haven't done, there's a process and they haven't done it, so the parents are running around like that. It's not part of their culture to do it, but they should be doing it.
I think that's something I know my son had extra time, but my daughter is dyslexic and she gets breaks.
Okay.
Yeah. So she gets
a defined
amount of time, where she can just go out and then go back in.
We have breaks as well. I don't usually use the breaks because I find when once my brain's involved, I've got to keep going.
But if you don't use them, you can use them.
Yeah, that's another thing. Because I get support for my coursework, and if I don't use enough of that, I can lose that.
Yeah.
So I tend to try every week to at least meet up with her. Yeah. She's really helpful. So, I mean,
how do you find the support you get? Is it useful? Yeah. So you get a specialist mentor and an academic mentor, is that right? And how do they help you?
No, the specialist mentor just asks about what I've been doing for the last week or so. And just helps me a bit with noticing things.
And they do come up with helpful things. You're not just sitting there and not knowing what to talk about.
Not really.
This is school or college?
University.
That happened to me a little bit at the beginning of uni because I was just floating around, not really knowing. And because I had come from a different uni, it wasn't my old uni's job to make sure where I was really. And because I didn't know where I was and I was growing with all these deadlines, I almost didn't find the time to seek help and I didn't know where to seek help. And I said this to my tutor and he said, surely you knew the Learning Gateway was there because you emailed them. And I said, but at my old uni, the Learning Gateway was just an exam area, so they would just sort out the exams and that would be that. I didn't know it was somewhere you could go and talk, really, and I just emailed them in a panic. So he said, he apologised and he said, we should have made sure you were okay. So you did go off the radar a bit because I didn't know who you were. And that is bad of them. But I guess at uni they just expect you to get on with it and seek to help yourself and things like that. So learning gateway was really good, but it was that initial. Okay, is there any more questions or anything?
I'm sorry, I missed the beginning. Mutism. I suppose the question is, does it affect some situations more than others, and do you understand it?
It does. It affected me when I was younger, so I didn't speak apart from to my parents, and if anyone was around, I would whisper to them. And it did affect me greatly because I couldn't read or write or get any support at school because I didn't talk, so they didn't know where I was at really. So that did affect me a lot, but it was good in a way because then that led on to my autism diagnosis because something was clearly not right. And mostly it was a negative thing because it was so much anxiety. That's what caused it, just because I had so much anxiety. And even now it's affecting me. Like, I can get nervous 1 minute, I'm fine, then what if this, what if that could go wrong, you know? And usually I keep it all sort of in my head, and then everything tends to be fine. But it does sort of stick with you, and that's why I'm quite a quiet person anyway, because I was completely quiet when I was younger. But there is positives to it, in the sense that it did lead on to autism diagnosis, and I did need that diagnosis, because it does get missed in girls.
Lucy would just freeze and stare at the floor.
Yeah.
When, if, say, one of my friends came round and said hello to Lucy, she'd just freeze and stare at the floor, and she would not move. And then I'd take my friend out of the room and Liberty would disappear up the stairs. But especially, well, we call him Troggy. He stuck with it, and gradually Liberty came forward and, you know.
It's the first
initial, but it went on for, it was a long time, it was, but, you know, he'd just walk in and say, hello, Liberty, how are you? And then take himself away from the situation so he didn't disturb Liberty in any way.
When someone does did something like that, like say hello, is it because it's unpredictable? Or is it feel like a demand on you that you have to sort of
I think
fulfill?
Originally it's unpredictable, so I didn't know how to deal with that situation. But then if it was forced, I think then it would be like definitely not gonna in any way communicate with you. So if someone said, hey, how are you, maybe walked off or just carried on, I would be more likely to talk to them. But if they were like carried on pestering, that is definitely
pressure for a response.
Yeah, because it happened in school, because this was when I didn't have mutism, and there was a new head teacher, and I didn't get on with this boy, did I?
No.
And she put me and him in a room, and she said, you're going to stay here till you talk. And this was her first day, actually. Yeah, so me and him just sat there and didn't say anything for ages. And we could have gone on like that, I don't know how long. So then this other teacher came and said, what's happening? So she got us out of that room and said, you know, that's not the way to deal with it. And after that, I didn't speak to her again. That was it. I could just completely not talk to her. So
you blanked her.
I blanked her, yeah.
Because she behaved badly.
Yeah. And I was like, not even going to... She say hi to me. So it does happen like that. It's not so much now. I probably would struggle with completely different people now. But when I was younger, I could just... That's it. Done with you. Even after the whole mutism thing, I could revert back almost. No, yeah. I definitely don't think I could do what I used to do. I don't think I could ever not talk now. Even though I'm still quiet, it just imagining that, I can't think. I don't think I could. But it's interesting because I know quite a few people are still mute and still only talk to certain people, and I don't know if that's just maybe they didn't get the help they needed or they just choose not to. And now, lately, sign language has been very popular with mute people, and I really like that because then they don't have to feel like they use words and they're perfectly happy to use their hands.
Do they use BSL or is it Makatone?
I think it's BSL, but I'm not sure. Yeah, I think it is. Someone was telling me that.
Makatone is for people who don't have full grasp of language,
right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
So BSL can be used for people who are sick?
Well, BSL can be used by anyone who's got hands.
Yeah, it's really useful.
There's people in the community who can't speak but don't like it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't.
It sucks.
yeah,
pretty much.
Of course, being able to fluently communicate sometimes, this is kind of right, really, and when people don't have it, of course, it's happened, but there's various ways in which the community understands it's like there should be provisions for people to learn, and they don't have to. It should be the case of your relative or child and got muted among other people for whatever other reason, and then you learn, and then it's like this pariah discipline.
It can also happen periods where people speak and periods where people don't speak. Again, I think of Jimmy and Ben, he's got a period where you can, for 6 months or a year, not talk. Whenever he's fine, and I'm fine, but I was looking. They tend to use iPad or laptop with text to speech.
What's his name?
Jimmy. Jimmy and Lyon is on Twitter. I think it's Jimmy and Lyon, one of his websites. He's an ex-Smile Space Island, I think. One of his youngest one bloggers. He works at the BBC.
So can I ask about sort of help that you've had? Is the best help the help where they didn't push it, where it wasn't? So I think that comes back to things like ABA being very quite unpleasant. I don't know, but it's quite rigid rather than saying what do you want to do, how safe do you feel, are you comfortable, I suppose.
Well, half of the reason because I was very stubborn, is that because I couldn't do it, so I'm trying to think of an example. So I couldn't write or read when I was very young. So they were, my first school were like, okay, write in a diary of your weekend. Obviously, I didn't talk to them either, so I couldn't even tell them that I couldn't write. So what I did was write a bunch of letters, and then they made me do that several times, and then I think they just realised that either I couldn't be bothered or that I was honestly couldn't write. And that's what sort of sparked it. But I think with the help, it definitely works if you don't force. So maybe go on to something else is a good way of doing it. So if I was with Miss James, I would have off days. She'd be like, okay, we're going to make the scrapbook today. And I'd be like, not today. We're not doing that today. We want to do something else. And she'd be like, okay, we're going to do something else. And I think that worked really well. Just keeping my mind active. And that worked a lot. And obviously the reward system as well worked a lot. So I could play a board game in the afternoon, something like that. So that worked well, but if I was forced, that brings a lot of anxiety as well, because I think, what if I can't do that, you know? Even at uni, I'm like, with some things, and they say, you shouldn't put yourself down, because you probably can do that, and if you can't, then that's not a problem, you'll sort it out. So, it's definitely, I don't like being forced.
What's the best thing about being autistic to you?
The best thing? Probably the fact that I can help others, that makes me really happy, but also my love for animals. So,
which ones?
Cats are probably my thing. I love cats, don't I? There was a cat in the street earlier and I had to go say hello. But I can almost relate to them in the sense that because quite a few of them are prey animals, and because of my anxiety with my work, say if one of them's acting weirdly, I can try and work out why that is. So there was this rabbit that just wouldn't move. And this was unusual for her, because you get to know their personalities, because you work with them all the time. And they just couldn't work out why it wasn't moving. And I saw this yellow bag, and I said, it's probably the yellow bag, because it's bright, and it's when the wind's on it, you can hear it. And it's probably bothering them quite a bit, so we moved in and started moving. So, yeah, that's what it is. Like, you almost think like a prey animal when you've got autism. Pardon?
You say you think like a...
Almost like a prey animal, because you're always on guard and you're always...
A prey.
Yeah, prey. You're always on guard, a bit like a prey animal is. So you sort of get to know what would make me anxious,
make them anxious, I suppose.
That's really good.
That explains it.
Yeah. So that George works really well.
It seems like your special interest has also, what do you call it that? That's what you're talented in and what is actually something you really enjoy is now becoming half, isn't it? Which is really good.
And Lucy's never had any fear of any kind of animal, as she would.
They will love me.
There's things she's worked with, and I thought, well, I wouldn't pick that up.
No, I had to do an interview actually because we work at country shows and things like that and take the animals and show people. And I wasn't keen on presentations, so I'm still not really, but I was holding the snake and called Simon, my hungry dog.
The plastic show in the way the snake.
Yeah, and with animals, when I'm holding them, just all my anxiety goes. And my boss at Joe said, right, you're going to do an interview. And I said, okay, fine. So I was walking with the snake around the country show, which you can imagine was very popular. So I went into this tent and there was a crowd of people, like loads of people, and this radio show. And I was like, oh, okay. So I was holding the snake and I walked up on the stage. And actually holding the snake made me more calm. And most people, that would be the worst thing in the world, while being recorded, while on the radio, while having people watching, and holding a snake. But actually, I was so calm. She was like, I can't believe you did that.
That was perfect.
Yeah, it was a perfect scenario.
And you met Chris Packham, sorry.
I messaged him on Twitter, but he didn't reply. But, how dare he. But I find him really interesting. And, like, very, I can relate to his sort of work. I think he's so much more knowledgeable than I am, but his work is really good. I really like it, and it's same with like autistic gardener. Has anyone heard of that? Yeah. Even though it's flowers, I like how that's his thing, and I like people with their things, and my thing is animals. And like Temple Grandin, hers is animals, and I like getting to know people and their things, you know.
Not in the same way, but everybody.
I think the thing that I liked about the Chris Packham documentary was when he was in his, he lives in a wood, doesn't he? He lives in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
So you think it'd be really peaceful, but he said there's so much going on out there that he notices in nature that he had to pull all the blinds down. He said, I have to create, even here, I have to create a really quiet space because he's so tuned in to everything that's happening around him. It's just like, I don't have experience like that, and it was really interesting.
Yeah, I watched his show, and he would taste things, like animals, just to see what it was. I can't remember exactly what he said, but feeling things and tasting things gave him more knowledge, almost. And I find that so interesting. I personally wouldn't, but it's a really interesting way of thinking, because obviously it's not just your head, like if you feel things and touch things, and obviously you learn in that way as well. He's very sensory, he relates to senses, I think, so that's really interesting. And he's really open about it now. I don't think he was a few years ago, but now he's really open about his work. I find it so interesting.
Who is it?
Chris.
Wildlife.
Yeah. Yeah, and also the fact that he can openly speak on a wildlife show amazes me as well. Because obviously he's quite confident with that as well. Yeah, that's his thing. I like that sort of thing as well. But I'm more domestic animals, I think. I'm really into my domestic animals.
I think the library wants us to leave by 8.
Okay.
So.
All right.
But if there's anything else anybody would like to know.
Thank you, Lisa.
That's all right. Thank you. Thank you.
Thanks very much again to Libby for giving us permission to record her talk. Libby's special interest is in animals, but she didn't get to speak nearly as much on that as we wanted to hear, so we're arranging her to come on the show and chat with us a bit more, which you will hear on an upcoming episode. Until then, thanks for listening.